I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about books. This is The Book Show, and our mission is to spread the word on great reads, fiction and nonfiction. We invite your calls, as always. And in the third segment, we have an author interview, which is a lot of fun for us. My book buddies are here and always excited to tell you about reads they love. We're going to go first to Amy Bloom, a novelist who lives in Connecticut and is up first. She is author of the novel, her most recent book, Lucky Us. Amy, what book do you have to tell us about?
It's actually a pair of books. It is the reissue of the Memoirs of Family Life by the amazing Shirley Jackson, the only writer I ever knew of, who had a short story in The New Yorker and one in the Ladies' Home Journal and one in a journal about paranormal life all at the same time on the same week.
Oh, that is the best story.
And so her work is, these are two books of essays, one called Raising... one is called, I think, Raising Demons, and the other one is called Life with Savages. And they are stories of her life as a housewife and mother and faculty wife and, of course, extraordinary writer, raising four children. And they are hilarious and charming. There is an essay about sitting on the side of a hill watching her son play Little League and trying to behave herself. Really? While in the presence of other mothers towards whom she is feeling rage, envy, contempt, homicide, all the while trying to be a well-behaved, adult woman. She also has stories of her little kids who disappear one day, and she begins the paragraph by saying something. It's not that I actually believed they would run away from home if I did not get up in time to make some pancakes on the weekend, but nevertheless, there are no children in my house.
Oh, my God.
Just very funny, and in fact, this is a pretty glossy version, I suspect, of her life, but it is just very wry and very funny about the interactions between the kids, between the loving but largely oblivious father. At one point, one of the children who has an imaginary friend actually gets her father to spend 2 hours reading Alice in Wonderland out loud to the imaginary friend. And when Shirley goes outside to find her daughter, she says, "Why are you out here? Daddy is reading to you." And she said, "No, he's reading to Marilyn. I got a little restless."
That's great. Okay, so author name and the names of the books again?
Shirley Jackson, and they're two slim volumes about family life, one called A Life with Savages and the other one called Raising Demons.
That is great. Thank you so much, Amy Bloom.
My pleasure.
All right, see you soon.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. All right, we go now to Pat Towers, who is one of our regular readers, Lucky Us. She was a founding editor of Vanity Fair, the weekly magazine 7 Days. She's held all these positions in book publishing and journalism, Harcourt, Mirabella, Elle, O Magazine. She was the editor at the New York, and editor at the New York Times Book Review. And so I'm always so interested in what she has. And we have Roxanne Cody coming up in just a second. Okay, Pat Towers, welcome back. What do you have?
Well, I've got the Canadian author Emily St. John Mandel. It's the first book of hers I've read. It's called Station 11. It was shortlisted for the National Book Award in October. And she'd written detective fiction before, but this is a different kind of thing. She really does have the imagination of disaster. I happen to love these sort of edgy novels like that. It's a wonderful opening. There's a world-famous actor in the movies and on stage, and he's playing King Lear in Toronto, and he has a heart attack on stage. And a young man in the audience realizes before anyone else what's happening, rushes toward the stage to help, but it's too late. And then starts to happen, everyone is, of course, terribly upset, and the actors are talking afterwards, the stage people, and the people are in this bar talking about it and what has just happened. And then the chapter ends with a line something like, all of those people would be dead in 2 weeks. And it's one of those openings that you think, wow. And so what happens is there's a terrible epidemic from Russia, the Georgian flu, and people arrive in Toronto on a plane from Russia, and with hours, all of them are dead. And then the book then takes place among the survivors in the years after this disaster.
This sounds good.
It's a page-turner. And through it is a troupe of musicians and a troupe of actors who have come together in this wasteland. You know, there are no planes, there's no electricity, there's no gas. And this is really a post-apocalyptic novel, if I can say that. But she wanted to do something different. What she wanted to write about was literary fiction, but with a strong narrative drive. And she said she found herself wanting to write a love letter to the modern world. And one way to write about something is to write about its absence. So she got rid of everything about the modern world and went back to when we had nothing. It's quite fascinating.
What a gorgeous way to put that, Pat. Really, that is so fantastic. So author name of the book again, just so everybody listening can get it.
Station 11. By Emily St. John Mandel.
Beautiful. Okay. We have Lee Jacobus coming up also. Roxanne Cody is with us normally in the studio. She is founder and president of R.J. Julia Booksellers, the independent bookstore in Madison, Connecticut. You're in New York this time, Roxanne.
Yes, ma'am.
What do you have, ma'am?
Well, I read overnight this weekend, The New Gone Girl, which is called Disclaimer.
Yes, I can't wait to hear about this.
So this is, you know, a happily married couple living in London, grown son living in his own apartment. And then, in a way that is utterly confusing to her, a book shows up on her bedside stand called The Perfect Stranger. And where you normally have the disclaimer saying, any relationship to someone alive that you might know is fiction, there's a red line crossed through it. And the book is the story, with other names, of a secret, horrible thing that happened that this woman did 20 years before. And she is terrified. She's managed to keep this a secret. The only other person that she knows would know it is dead. And this is the story of how everything unravels. Everything unravels. And how ideas that you might have of your spouse or your mother or your friend or your coworker get blown up, whether they get blown up appropriately or inappropriately. It's got an ending that, like all good endings in mysteries, will stun you. And there was a review of it in the Times the other day, but Janet Maslin, and she had the one hiccup about this book that I think is exactly right. There's an ending after the ending. The penultimate ending is brilliant. But the ending after the ending feels gratuitous, and I don't even know why she had it, and she didn't need it.
Was there some editor involved?
Yeah. Who knows what, you know, somebody wanted something tidy. But this book has, as you know, and probably some of the listeners know, I'm not a big mystery thriller reader, but when they do what this does, I'm a mystery
fan. Oh, yeah. This is so, I am so thrilled you talked about this, because I had read Janet Maslin in the New York Times talking about this, and I thought, well, this sounds great. So it's Disclaimer by Renee Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T.
Exactly.
Oh, excellent, excellent.
It's going to be the, you know, the beach read of the summer.
Yes, it's just what I'm looking for. Okay. Lee Jacobus is here with us, and he's author of college textbooks of all kinds. And also a collection of short stories called Hawaiian Tales in paperback. Lee, what's up? What's well, first for you?
Well, I want to call attention to Adam Gopnik's remarkable article in The New Yorker on May 4th. He talks about Trollope's novel, The Way We Live Now, because this is, of course, the 200th anniversary of Trollope's birth, and so there have been a lot of things going on. The fascinating thing is that he's got 47 books that are in print. I mean, literally, in print.
I was shocked. I had no idea.
It's astounding. But the thing about the way we live now, it's just a stunning book, really. We just read it in our classics book group. It's a huge book, but, you know, you go through it just like a hot knife through butter. You just read it and just get caught up in it entirely. What it's about is a man named Melmotte who drifts in from the continent into England. Everybody assumes that he's a man of enormous fortune, and he sets up a railroad scheme that goes from someplace in the States down to Veracruz in Mexico, and he just gets everybody involved. Everybody throws their money into it, and it has a terrific cast of characters, really extraordinary people. And the thing, of course, is that he's a Madoff. He's exactly what Madoff. He just cons everybody. But there's a neat little detail which not many people would catch. He throws a gigantic and very expensive dinner for the Emperor of China. And of course, the reality is the Emperor of China no Emperor of China has ever left China. In fact, they rarely leave, you know, any place more than a couple of miles from where they were born. He's conned too. It's an extraordinary book. And it's called The Way We Live Now.
So when you read Adam Gopnik, did it make you then pick up Trollope? Is that how you did?
No, actually. I had already read the book just before. I just finished it just when I read the
article. It made me want to pick up Trollope.
Oh, it's terrific.
When was Trollope writing?
Well, this was 1874.
1874. And that premise of the person who's poser, you know,
right,
has just been around forever, I guess.
Well, it has. Look, there's another thing that I've got to mention, too. Do you know that Émile Zola in 1891 wrote another novel called Money, in which he has a fellow named Jacquard who is on the bourse, and he does the same thing.
Yeah,
he inflates the value of a totally non-existent company. Everybody gets into it. Everybody wants to make money, and it's just extraordinary. I mean, to read these two novels together.
I wonder who's written about the – who was the first con artist? I wonder. It's kind of an interesting –
it's got to be in the Bible somewhere.
It's a good study for somebody.
Yeah.
The wonderful book by Thomas Mann, Felix Krull.
Oh, of course, Felix Krull.
Gorgeous book.
Oh, too. That's a magnificent book, and you're right, and that is a perfect example.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, reading Trollope is marvelous because everybody loves Trollope. They love the Barchester books, and they love the Pallister books, and he reads so well, and he writes so well. It's a joy to read it. It's The Way We Live Now, and it could be The Way We Live Now.
I love that. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and then round we go again with all these great readers of ours. We want to hear from you at 203-776-9677. No, yes, okay, we'll be right back with the book show. I'm Faith Middleton. This is The Book Show, and I am with the gang, our regulars. Appreciate them so much. At 203-776-9677, if you have a book that you love or you belong to a book club and there's something you've all been talking about, I wanted to mention that Janet Maslin, when she was doing her recent review of books for the summer, you know, making recommendations, she talked about this book, Look Who's Back, and it is described as a comic novel. This is about Hitler, and, you know, she raises this question, you know, is it appropriate to be thinking about even a send-up of Hitler as a beach read? So has any of our gang, has anybody read this? Roxanne, Pat?
I'm tempted, but I haven't done it yet.
Yeah.
Okay, Pat, you're the same?
No, I haven't read it, no.
Do you think you will?
I don't know. I've got a lot of books I want to read.
That's a tough question, always.
Top of my list. Yeah. I'm curious about it. Yeah. I'd like a friend to read it first and tell me what they thought.
Yeah. And you're the same, Lee, right?
Well,
yeah.
I don't know. But you know, the send-up of Hitler has started ages and ages ago. I mean, it started
Mel Brooks.
Yeah, well, and also, you know, Jack Benny in the 1940s or 1930s, really. I mean, this has gone on for a long time. I don't know what to make of it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
That Jack Benny did his send-up.
Yeah, The Horn Blows at Midnight, which is an old film. It's really been going on for ages.
Uh-huh. And here I thought Mel Brooks was so brave, you know.
Oh, well, yeah. He's very brave, yeah. Yes, if you like it the way he does it.
Yeah, okay. So so let's go back to Pat Towers. What do you have, Pat?
Well, interesting that you're talking about Hitler, because I have I just read Jim Shepard's new book, The Book of Aaron. It's his seventh novel, and it's been getting incredible reviews around the country. And it is about that Aaron, this boy who's the narrator, the child narrator, has the bad luck to be born around 1930 in Poland near Lithuania. So he's 8 or 9 when the Germans invade Poland, September 1, 1939, and he's living in Warsaw with his hard-working, you know, poor family and a sickly brother, and it's quite a book. The voice of this child is what it sounds like. It begins with, "My mother and father named me Aaron, but my father said they should have named me 'What have you done?' And my uncle told everyone they should have called me 'What were you thinking?' I broke medicine bottles by crashing them together and let neighbors' animals loose from pens. My uncle told my mother that my kind of craziness was like stealing from the rest of the family. When I complained about it, my mother reminded me I had only myself to blame, and that in our family, the cure for a toothache was to slap the other side of your face." Well, this boy is our witness to the unthinkable events that unfold in that Warsaw ghetto, when it became a ghetto. Uh-huh. And it's just little by little, like the frog in a pot of water as it slowly comes to a boil. And he doesn't think well of himself, and he's a bit of a scamp, and he gets involved with other kids who begin to, when the Germans little by little push the Jews all into one space and then into a smaller space, and the food rations are less and less. He sort of forages and gets outside and trades things and brings food back. But the other center of the book is this real person, Dr. Janusz Korczak, who in this period... he was a very famous pediatrician. He was on the radio. They called him the old doctor, and he told children stories. And he was very loved all throughout Europe. And so the Nazis actually thought rather highly of him. He had an orphanage, and he was in the ghetto. And he went around trying to get money to keep these children in with some food. And finally, in the end, he goes with the children. He could have left. They want him out. They want to rescue him. But he won't. He goes with the children to Treblinka, and that's that final thing. And the sort of tension of the book is what you know as a reader and what this boy does not know. And this extraordinary doctor who believes so strongly in children's rights. Well, this whole catastrophe was one of the most unthinkable things in our history, among a few others. But somehow, by telling it from the child's point of view, it just becomes so alive. And the moral questions, as people are pushed into positions in order to protect someone else, they give this up. And you know, the whole way that the law was, first there were the Jewish policemen with the yellow bands, and there were the Polish police with the blue and blue, and then there were the German and green. And the sort of diabolic way that the Nazis set this up was to have the leaders of the Jewish community run things and little by little say, well, we need you to do this, but if you do this, you don't have to do that. And this little boy, of course, gets caught up in exactly those things without even knowing what's happening. And you sort of see it spread before you, and it really makes you stop and think again about all of it.
It's so personal. So, so personal, it sounds
like.
Yeah. The Book of Aaron. And the author was?
Jim Shepherd, The Book
Jim
of
Shepherd,
Aaron.
Right, yeah. The Book of Aaron. Thank you so much, Pat. Roxanne Cody, what's up for you?
So, Faith, this is one of these books that we wonder why we didn't write this, why we didn't think of it,
okay.
I should say. So it's called The Lists of Note. And it has, for instance, a handwritten note from Evelyn Lincoln, who was President John Kennedy's secretary, who was on the plane that brought back Johnson and Jacqueline Kennedy and the body of John Kennedy, and she wrote out a list of who she thought killed Jack Kennedy, which included Lyndon Johnson, Jimmy Hoffa, the KKK. And then it's got a list from Johnny Cash of what he needs to do today, like not smoke, kiss June, not kiss anybody else, cough, pee, eat, not eat too much, worry, go see mama, and practice piano.
Now, wait a minute. Is this, it's called the list of?
Notes.
Notes.
And then it's got hundreds of notes. It's got things like.
Whose notes? I mean, are these real notes?
Real notes. And people, you know, it's Pablo Picasso's notes on who should be invited to a 1912 exhibit. It's Benjamin Franklin's the Drinker's Dictionary. It's a note from Peter Roget, from Roget's Thesaurus. It's got this list of reasons for admission to the West Virginia Hospital for the Insane from October 19, 1864 to December 12, 1889, which includes things like fever and loss of lawsuit, business nerves, cold, congestion of brain, decoyed into the army, disappointed affection, disappointed love, plain old disappointment, dissolute habits, a dog bite, domestic affliction, indigestion, intemperance, hysteria.
Wow.
Oh my God.
This is such a good idea.
You know, it's a great graduation gift. It's a great fun book to have. But the one that really, really struck me when I was going through it is this was a note that Mahatma Gandhi wrote to his, in 1947 to his grandson, what he described as the seven social sins. And I think these are, you know, good framework for how we live our life. And the seven social sins are wealth without work, pleasure without conscience, knowledge without character, commerce without morality, science without humanity, worship without sacrifice, and I love the last one, politics without principles.
Well, that should be published.
Cool, huh?
That's pretty cool,
cool,
yeah. That should be writ large.
It's such a great, you know, this is from that Letters Unbound, which I think I've spoken about. It's a gentleman out of England who started putting these together. They were a website, and I had subscribed to it where it would send you letters of note. It might be, you know, F. Scott Fitzgerald and his editor. It might be Beethoven to his brother. It might be, you know, and all these crazy real things. And now we put together these lists of note.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, it's great.
Oh,
it's the most fun.
Oh, okay. Okay. Lee Jacobus, what do you have for us?
Well, I want to talk about Patrick Modiano's novels called Suspended Sentences. Now, Patrick Modiano won the Nobel Prize. He's a French writer.
For literature.
For Nobel Prize for literature. He's a French writer who is not well known in this country at all. Yale published a book with three short novels. They're called Suspended Sentences, which is the title of the overall book. And After Image is one of them, and Flowers of Rain. Now, these are extraordinary because they move from the wartime Paris to the modern days, 1960s Paris. What I loved about it is the clear and beautiful writing that he does. It's so absolutely clear, so absolutely moving in its very simple way. He talks about Paris. He describes it in detail. You really get a sense of where you are, what it's like. He's in the Left Bank a great deal, and you really have a feeling of the city. But what he's doing here is fascinating. He's constantly mulling over the problem of his father, the character's problem of his father, because he thinks his father may have been in a gang during the war, doing things that were basically illegal and not necessarily important to the resistance. Now, that's partly something that, in fact, in Patrick Modiano's life is also true, as he doesn't know much about his own father. Mm-hmm. So you get this sense of absolute mystery all the time. This is really three novels that are constantly dealing with mysteries that are of such complexity that they're fascinating, and they're like what you have in your own life in terms of complexities. So, but I loved, as I say, the writing, the quality, simply lovely. Simply, and I say simple, and I mean simply because it is so clear, pellucid kind of prose. It's marvelous. Mm-hmm. And this sense of Paris, it just brought so much back to me of Paris. And he gives you a good sense of what it was like during the war. He's really a good writer. Mm-hmm. We really should know more about him.
And all the planes are to Paris is sold out right now on all the major airlines. So this is good armchair travel, by
yes,
the way.
Yes, indeed. So it's Patrick Modiano, and it's called Suspended Sentences, and Yale publishes it. It's terrific.
Okay, excellent. Okay, Pat Towers, what do you have next?
I have the book that Anne Enright has just published called The Green Road. She's a writer, Irish writer. I just love the way she puts sentences together and the way she observes people. She's just deeply observant. She's incredibly deft. James Wood talked about it in The New Yorker, and he said, this is storytelling with the blood pulse of lived gossip. And it's so... Mm-hmm. Irish, and she gets to the essence of each moment with a sudden, sort of accurate phrase. It's so telling that, you know, when I find myself, you kind of get tears of pleasure in my eyes because it's so precise. She knows her people, and in this novel, this is a family about the Madigans, Irish family in the west of England, and the matriarch is Rosaline, who's the daughter of the town pharmacist, and she's courted by all the best young men, but she marries a Madigan who's a little beneath her, a good man, but not quite at the social scale she's supposed to, and they have four children, two boys and two girls, and you first see them through the eyes of the 12-year-old Hannah at a Sunday dinner just before Easter, like Palm Sunday, and the oldest boy, Dan, whom the young Hannah adores, says, at the table, he says, I've been talking to the priest. And there's a kind of little silence. And he said, and I think I want to become a priest. And the mother, Rosaline, there's this, oh! And she starts gasping and puts her head down. And then she lifts her head. And then this description of her at the table, and the tears are coming down her cheeks, and she's making these sounds. At the same time, she's putting carrots in her mouth. It's just one of those moments at a dinner table in a family. I mean, the essence of family drama, it's extraordinary. And she does this throughout the book. She's just a wonderful writer.
So The Green Road is it Anne Enright?
Anne Enright.
Oh, yeah. Pat, in my world, if anybody said, you couldn't say a finer thing about a novel than that it brought you tears of pleasure. That is such a beautiful phrase. I want to read every single thing that all of you have been talking about. We're going to have an author interview in about 4 minutes. Roxanne Cody, what do you have?
I want to talk about Fun Home by Alison Bechdel.
Yeah.
It's been getting a lot of attention as a Tony nominee and a play, but I fell in love with the book. And I think the book, in some ways, is probably sacrilegious to say, is actually better than the play because it's more nuanced and fuller than I think a play can really do. It's a graphic novel. She is a young gay woman and one of three kids, grew up in a home with two parents. The father was a gay man, which you learn very quickly in the play, but closeted. And it's about how he deals with her, how she deals with her own coming of age, what happens to the dad, what happens to the family. And she's, you read this and you are so with her. You so understand the complexity of all families trying to accommodate what's going on and how we keep secrets, why we keep secrets, how we deal with secrets, how we have willful blindness. And so I really, if you don't get to see the play, you definitely pick up the graphic novel. It's called Fun Home. And Fun Home is actually, fun is actually short for funeral.
Yeah.
Because the family owned a funeral home, and the kids used to always have to help and work at the funeral home, hence the name Fun Home.
Okay. So Alison Bechdel, and that's Roxanne Cody of R.J. Julia Booksellers in Madison, Connecticut. Our regular Pat Towers has been on with us, Lee Jacobus, author of Hawaiian Tales, and earlier, Amy Bloom, author of the novel Lucky Us. I want to say thanks to all of you. Roxanne, very quick question for you. In the 2 minutes we have until our author interview, which is Speed Limits, Where Time Went and Why We Have So Little Left by Mark Taylor of Columbia University. When you picked up Alison Bechdel's graphic novel the first time, did it take you a while to get into that? I mean, some people have just grown up with graphic novels. I don't care, even if you've read comic books as a kid, it was nothing like these now sophisticated graphic novels. Did it take you a while to get into it?
Well, the thing that really acclimated me was the classic Art Spiegelman mouse books, which I read all three when they came out a number of years ago.
Right.
And that was, for anyone who doesn't know, those are about the Holocaust. Those really acclimated me. I love graphic novels.
So interesting.
I find they work for me. People, it's a
thing.
I think you've got it exactly right, Faith. It's an acquired taste.
Yeah. Well, that happened to me with The Color Purple all those years ago. Alice Walker, it took me a minute.
The dialect.
Dialect and letters, and then when I was in the swing, I was lost and in heaven reading that book. So thank you all so, so much for being on the show and talking about these books. I just want to read everything. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Lee and Pat and Roxanne and Amy. We're going to next talk to Mark Taylor. Stay with us here on The Book Show. I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for being a part of our show. I've been having the best time on this particular edition. We're going to turn now to an author conversation, and it is a very interesting and smart book. I just want to let you know, though, that we have set up, we're calling it the hottest scene in Connecticut. It really is. It's our Food Schmooze Martini Competition, where all the statewide bartenders shake up innovative martinis, and you vote for the Food Schmooze Martini Champion. We have a designated driver discount, great top chef noshes, the DJ sizzles. It sells out every time. It is Thursday, June 25th at 6 p.m. at Simsbury's Riverview, thanks to Power Station Events, $60 tickets. You can order them now at ctmartini.org, and you will see a button on the right-hand side of the page to order tickets, ctmartini.org. We applied to the Guinness Book of World Records, by the way, to for this very martini event that we're talking about. So this will be interesting. Okay, we have now Mark Taylor. He's written Speed Limits, Where Time Went, and Why We Have So Little Left. It is published by Yale University Press. They do such a great job in their selections. So here we go. This was very, very smart, I thought, as I read this book. He says, Mark, as we welcome him, call waiting, endless conference calls, mandatory Skype meetings, no matter where you are or what time it is, urgent weekend business trips to deal with what could have waited until Monday, just in time, everything, sleeping with an iPhone beside the bed, checking email all night, receiving email while in a cab heading to dinner with a friend and returning to the office, longer and longer workday weeks, week after week, 70, 80, 90 hours without a break. In real time, everything speeds up until time itself seems to disappear, and fast is never fast enough. Everything has to be done now, instantly, to pause, to delay, to stop, to miss an opportunity, and to give a competitor the edge. Speed has become the measure of success. Faster chips, faster computers, faster networks, faster connectivity, faster news, faster communications, faster transactions, faster delivery, faster product cycles, faster brains, faster kids, faster lives. According to the gospel of speed, the quick inherit the earth. Yep, that about sums it up. That sounds like life right now. Mark Taylor, welcome to the show.
Delighted to be here.
So let me say, I forgot to say that you are professor and chair, Department of Religion at Columbia University. You're a cultural critic and a leading philosopher, as I know. Okay, Mark, this has been talked about, you know, to some degree, what we're losing. What did you set out to do, your different take on this?
Well, one thing I tried to do was to show how this condition has emerged and to show the different aspects of our lives that it influences. The section you read suggests some of that. But it's not just faster computers, but it pervades all of our lives. It's fast food, it's fast networks, it's fast fashion. And to try to really understand how all of this interconnects and how it has emerged, because all of this really begins by going during the Industrial Revolution. And I trace it back, my own reflection on this, to two things. One, conversations with my father I used to have, who was raised on a Pennsylvania farm in the early 20th century, and his life was not that different from what it had been 200 years ago. And in the last years of his life, we would often discuss whether he would have seen more he was born in 1907, whether he would have seen more changes than I would have. And he was always convinced that, you know, from the Wright brothers to Man on the Moon, he used to say that I would never see changes like he had. But of course, I have seen changes, and I think now they're even greater than during his life.
Can you explain this? Because this is interesting to me, where you talk about how I always catch myself saying to people, well, it's just like we were in a time just like the Industrial Revolution.
Right.
And everybody was so caught, and suddenly you're swept up in this dramatic change.
Right.
And I would think of that as a separate thing all by itself. And your contention in the book is that what we are doing right now is still part of that Industrial Revolution.
Yes, I think it's an extension of it. First of all, it's important to remember that many of the technologies that we see as so important today, the digital and electronic technologies, had their origin in the 19th century. You had telephone and telegraph, which developed in tandem with the railroads global system, because the lines were laid along the railroad lines. The first transatlantic cable, people forget, was completed in 1859. And much of the infrastructure that we now have for the physical infrastructure of the Internet follows pathways that were set down in the 19th century for telephone and telegraph cables. But in addition to that, as soon as one moved into industrial production, there came to be a premium put on speed and efficiency. And famously, Frederick Winslow Taylor about 1911 took his stopwatch quite literally into factories to time people to figure out the best way to make them most productive. If anybody's seen Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times, it's sort of embodied there.
Mm-hmm.
So this obsession with speed is tied to a particular economic structure. That's the point that needs to be seen.
Yeah, Mark, I love this part where you were saying, for instance, industrialization comes and we suddenly have to deal with train travel.
Correct.
And you write that this bodily acceleration had this enormous psychological effect that some people found completely disorienting, other people found it exhilarating.
Right.
But it was this mechanization of movement created what Anne Friedberg, you're quoting, describes as the mobile gaze.
Correct.
Which transforms one's surroundings and alters both the content and, more important, the structure of perception. So here's how it went. Does this sound like now? I'm quoting you. During the early years, there were numerous accounts of the experience of railway travel by ordinary people, distinguished writers, even physicians, in which certain themes recur. The most common complaint is the sense of disorientation brought about by the experience of this unprecedented speed.
Right.
And people would say to each other, the landscape is incessantly rushing by faster than we can apprehend it.
Right.
You say that when you researched, people said they suffered from overstimulation.
Right.
It created a sense of psychological exhaustion and physical distress.
Right.
And physicians began to make claims about that speed was causing things like neuralgia, tooth decay, even premature baldness.
I mean, it sounds just like hyperactivity and attention deficit disorder today.
Yeah.
And was treated as such. One important thing to realize that the first thing that speed produces is a sense of slowness. That is to say, the horse wasn't slow until you had the car, right? And your new computer, your old computer isn't slow until you get your new computer. So it's the constant acceleration of all the technologies and of all parts of life. But I think the important question to ask is what is driving this? Obsession with speed.
Yes.
And the way I've come to understand that, I mean, over the years, I've done a lot of work in both in my writing and my teaching with new technologies. When the Internet emerged and the World Wide Web and everything, there was this grandiose sense that these new technologies, as always the way it is, were going to liberate us. And in 1971, President Nixon actually appointed a commission to explore how we would deal with the problem when in 20 or 25 years people would only be working 20 hours a week,
mm-hmm.
and we were going to have so much leisure time. There are paradoxes with the way in which these technologies have developed. These technologies that were supposed to save us time now take all of our time. We're wedded to them. The iPhone has become the ball and chain. You're never unplugged. You're working 24/7, 365. These technologies that were supposed to connect us are dividing us. It has not created the global village Marshall McLuhan anticipated, but rather creates these bubbles in which each individual is plugged into with his earbuds, with his own playlist and his own newspaper. So that there are these paradoxes: the more connected we become, the more divided we become.
So together alone, as you say in the book.
Together alone, exactly.
Why did why was speed the golden child? As we can see with the Internet, yes, of course, this makes things easier. You get more done. Back then, industrialization. But why does everyone resort to speed? It's not enough to get more.
Right.
We must keep going as fast as we can. Why that?
Because time's money. It's the economic system that we've created. We have created an economic system that is dependent upon what I believe is to be unsustainable economic growth. If you have a system in which economic well-being is measured by growth, and that's recent, it's a product of really the Cold War, we could talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
But if economic well-being is measured by growth, there are only three ways markets can expand. Spatially, you open a new branch in another town or another country. Differentially, you create more different products. The average American supermarket today has 48,000 different products. Or temporally, you accelerate the product cycle. When Obama was elected, the iPhone hadn't even been introduced. So the obsession with speed and the constant claims about creative disruption and innovation is simply a way of expanding the market through planned obsolescence. If people aren't borrowing and spending money they don't have for stuff they don't need in this constant turnover, the economy falters. So speed is intimately tied to a certain form of capitalism, really. And as you go from a consumer capitalism to this new form of capitalism that we have, which is financial capitalism, speed becomes even more of an item.
Because
In previous forms of capitalism, you make money by selling your labor or stuff. In this form of capitalism, big money is made by trading signs, by trading financial assets that are backed by nothing other than other signs. And virtual assets, you know, mortgage bond, all the derivatives and all that stuff, that scales at a rate much faster than real assets.
Yeah, so that explains the divide, the rich get richer
exactly.
And the poor get poorer.
But there's a point that people don't realize. The wealth gap is a speed gap. Mm. When I was in college, the people who were going to make money were going to be doctors. Not anymore, because being a doctor doesn't scale in the same way that high-speed, high-volume networks scale in billions and billions of dollars in nanoseconds. So the problem's structural.
Yeah. This is Mark Taylor. He's author of Speed Limits, Where Time Went and Why We Have So Little Left. You quote, I think it was Bertrand Russell, who wrote this essay in praise of idleness. And if I can say what you wrote here when you quote him, he explained, although my conscience has controlled my actions, my opinions have undergone a revolution. I think that there is far too much work done in the world, that immense harm is caused by the belief that work is virtuous. And what needs to be preached in modern industrial countries is quite different from what always has been preached.
Right.
He insists that only a foolish asceticism, usually vicarious, makes us continue to insist on work in excessive quantities now that the need no longer exists. So this is this divide between time and money.
Right.
It almost reads like a mortal sin to say something like that in this age that we're in.
You're absolutely right. And that underscores another important point, because another point that needs to be made here is that there has been a change in the social status of leisure. In previous eras and in different societies, social status is measured by how little you work. In our society, social status is measured by how much you work. If you're not wired 24/7, 365, you're not very important. And that's a profound change, it seems. We've heard the reports. Americans don't take all their vacation. Why? In large part, there are many reasons, but part of it is they're afraid they'll lose their jobs if somebody else will take it. But it's also it's a quasi-Protestantism, right, in certain ways.
Mm-hmm. You make that point.
Right, the virtue of work. And that's at the heart of our political debate, because it's complicated, but this kind of hostility towards so-called leisure is part of what is at the heart of the conservative critique of the social welfare system.
Mark, unfortunately, I could talk to you for this whole hour, but unfortunately we have about a minute left. So very quickly, why is this not the cycle of change that we always go through as human beings in a social culture?
Well, I think the notion of cycle suggests that this is continually renewable. Part of what needs to be seen is that the price of speed of this kind of economic system based upon speed makes demands, not only psychological, social, and economic demands, but it makes demands on the environment that cannot be sustained.
Mm-hmm.
That will be, I think, what will have to run.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you so much. Great book, Speed Limits, Mark C. Taylor. As always, this show is about the richness of life, and you can find all the things we talk about on our website, either at foodschmooze.org or The Faith Middleton Show. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.
I said, "Let's meet in heaven."